The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of The Home Show podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan, your host. Coming up this week, the presidential race is heating up. There are three candidates out and about looking for your vote. We're going to take a look inside what will become the new residence for one of them. As we head towards budget day, one man is tackling the housing crisis head on by promising to deliver 2,000 homes in 2 years in Limerick. The shops are already stocked with Halloween goodies, show regular Jennifer Sheehan giving us some wicked tips on how to do Halloween on a budget. If you'd like to get involved in the pod, you can text us 53106. You can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com and you'll find me on X and on Instagram. Now, the presidential race is heating up with the three candidates chosen. They're out and about trying to get your vote. Now, we don't generally do politics on The Home Show, but there's no doubt that one of them will have a new home by next month. And whichever of them wins, Jim Gavin, Heather Humphreys or Catherine Connolly, their move to Áras an Uachtaráin will be a big change of scene for them. But what is the history of the Áras and what can the next president of Ireland change there? Are any of them likely to do, oh, I don't know, a tacky overhaul like maybe that other White House that we know about? Well, joining me now with more, I'm sure he doesn't look hopeful, is Graham Hickey, CEO of Dublin Civic Trust. Graham, welcome to the Home Show studio. Now, this is a fabulous, iconic building, but let's start with the history of it for listeners who don't know much about it. It wasn't built as a presidential home. When was it built and what was it for?
Indeed, it's the most remarkable house. It's a magical house. I think not only because it has managed to survive. It's a survivor from a former regime, the British rule in Ireland, to transitioning as an icon, really, of the Irish state and Irish state ceremonial. But also just how it looks, this extraordinary, startling white lozenge kind of reclining in the verdant greens, the rolling plains of Phoenix Park. It's incredibly striking. And I think from a modern perspective, you've probably discussed it a lot on this programme, the whole idea of colour drenching.
Indeed.
Every bit of the Áras is white. So the facade, the architectural joinery, the windows, the chimneys, the chimney pots, and even very cleverly, all the elements of the Áras estate, the gas lamps, the estate railings, the beautiful wrought iron gates that kind of set the cue when you come in from Chesterfield Avenue, that whole sense of kind of a glowing white estate must be very striking for visiting heads of state, and for us as citizens seeing the house. It's a very remarkable, very striking thing that sets it apart from regular architecture.
I presume that's deliberate. Is it some like shining beacon kind of that you veer towards? Is that really the kind of the purpose of it, do you think? Or
in part pragmatism as well of how the house has evolved over the 19th century. But I suppose to your initial point about what the core of the house actually is, there was a house on the site since the 17th century, a house called Newtown Lodge, and that was eventually became the home of the chief ranger of the Phoenix Park. But all change really came about in 1751 when Nathaniel Clements, who was the big mover and shaker in Dublin, he had a huge mansion on Henrietta Street, he was the vice treasurer of Ireland, he was a man of huge influence, he was effectively the minister for finance for Ireland for the large part, big chunk of the middle of the 18th century. And he set about rebuilding Newtown Lodge. So he demolished the house and built a very beautiful cube of a house, a red brick cube. And to this day, that's the core of Áras an Uachtaráin.
Oh, so the white is a render over that then.
Interesting. So the core of the house is that kind of red brick block. And then in the very early on after the Act of Union, about 1802, the house was extended by another architect, Robert Woodgate. And then in the 1840s, for the visits of Queen Victoria, in the 1840s and 1850s, it was extended twice again. So it kind of by stealth, we ended up with this
wings,
palace, with this wing in the park.
Now, it was originally used as the Viceregal Lodge, which is presumably a post of the governor of Ireland from the old British rule. So it was always something majestic and important.
That's it. So Nathaniel Clements was a commoner. He's one of the few wealthy, non-titled people in Ireland. But he sold the house to the Crown in 1782. as a summer residence for the Viceroy, because at that time it was considered inappropriate that the state, or rather the Viceroy, would be both living and entertaining in the very dense environment of Dublin Castle. So if he could be removed out to the park, he'd have a choice, I suppose. So it became the Viceregal Residence, and then it just gradually expanded over the years, got grander and grander, right up until, in fact, it was extended again for a royal visit in 1911 for George V.
Okay.
So there's actually a bedroom wing with a whole series of bedrooms and bathrooms and sanitation that was introduced.
That was built
that
for
time.
Him. Now, of course, we didn't get our first president in Ireland until after independence. And was it always mooted as the official residence of the President of Ireland from back then, or were there other views about where they might live?
It's a very good point. It was not at all a clear trajectory from viceregal to presidential residence. And we forget, of course, there was the period when we had governors general, three governors general from 1922 up until about 1937. And there was a reluctance even at that point, because, of course, De Valera's government, particularly from 1932, wanted to reduce the status of the Governor General. So they actually hired a suburban house in Black Rock for the last... really put him in his place. And therefore, when the Constitution in 1937 allowed for a president, it's also included in the Constitution that the president shall reside in or near Dublin. It doesn't specify the particular residence. But De Valera... I mean, he was a sensitive person insofar as that he was very keen that all the symbolism in Dublin Castle would be retained. The throne room was maintained. The insignia of the Knights of St. Patrick and St. Patrick's Hall were retained. But in the case of the Lodge, the Viceregal Lodge, it was just seen as too much of a representation of imperial legacy. So a decision was made in 1937, because they were rooting around looking at St. Anne's in Raheny, or perhaps other large mansions that the president could live in. But eventually it was decided that the Arras would be demolished and a new presidential residence would be built on the site. And we have the First World War singularly to thank for the survival.
Because it just put all the plans into abeyance, and we were and then when they emerged then
it was
in 1918...
Closely associated
it was
with the presidency. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So who's in charge of it now? It's the OPW,
the
is
OPW.
It?
The OPW.
Okay. Right. Well, we
The OPW, they've carried out a lot of work. So after the war, the famous OPW architect, Raymond McGrath, he's a name maybe more familiar with the Donegal carpets that we're familiar with in a lot of state buildings that he designed. But he carried out major refurbishments and alterations to the house in a way that wouldn't be tolerated today from a conservation perspective. So he sliced through a lot of the more minor rooms. We're all probably familiar with the Lafranchini corridor, which is lined with plaster casts from Riverstown House in County Cork. So he created that from scratch. It's a kind of an historicist kind of corridor, and it's lined with the presidential busts. And he also carried out a lot of alterations to the bedrooms and introduced sanitation and modernised the house in a way that kind of brought it up to standard.
Okay, well, I won't ask you if he put in a bike shed, given the OPW's history in that regard. I have been lucky enough to be in the Arras for a reception many years ago. It was under Mary McAleese, and that room where things are signed and dignitaries are met, it's a beautiful, beautiful room, and you know, it is lovely. Tell us about the rest of the building. What do we know about the interior? How many rooms are there? And the private apartments, because they're there too, where they live.
Indeed, and that's, I think, the extraordinary thing is that we're perhaps familiar with the public, the state reception rooms and the state drawing room that you're referring to. But generally over the years, depending on the family makeup of the president, some of them prefer to live in the 1911 wing, particularly if they've children. There's a lot more rooms, there's a lot more bathrooms, it's more practical, I suppose. But Mary Robinson made the decision in 1990 that she would move into the house itself. So she was living upstairs in the original 1750s bedrooms of Nathaniel Clements. So they're kind of typical Irish country house bedrooms. You know, the big square rooms, good chunky joinery, coved ceilings, so slightly coved.
So they have that choice then.
They
can go in and just decide, I live in this bit or I live in that bit.
Absolutely, that's it. And in theory, it's a fully secure compound. So within the realms of that, there is flexibility.
Okay, how interesting. And does it come, can they live a normal life? Is there a kitchen, a sitting room? places they can meet friends that aren't state drawn. Although I have to say, if I was the president, I think I'd want all my friends, including my book club, to take place in the state
enough
rooms.
Space.
But is it like cozy at all?
There is. There is private rooms off the major state rooms. So even the president's study, which we're familiar with from TV, where Michael D. Higgins with his ranks of books,
piles of books.
That's kind of a semi-public room, but then there's also a private drawing room beyond that, and there's also more private rooms again.
Okay.
But what I would say, I suppose, overall about the interiors of the Arras, it's presented too much like a hotel. It should be presented more as a historic house. And I suppose when you think about it, it's been 14 years since the OPW has really managed to have a run at the Arras.
Yeah.
And there's only usually about 4 to 6 weeks where they can actually...
The transition.
Where you can really make your mark. And I'd say in that 14 years, conservation thinking and the presentation of historic rooms has advanced enormously, you know, up to National Trust standards. Mm. And the OPW are now achieving that in Dublin Castle, in Farmley, in Castletown House. Mm. And the Arras has never been subjected to that kind of rigour, research-based analysis, paint analysis, going through records to see how the rooms were originally presented.
Oh, so it could probably do then with a study.
It's a bit of a bling hotel, to be quite honest, I would say. And it does a lot of heavy lifting with receptions and events, so that's understandable. But there's a happy medium between introducing a bit more dignity, I think.
Okay. Well, of course, you know, bling and White House is really what we've come to expect on the other side of the pond. So I have to ask you, Graham, like, to what extent we've seen Donald Trump going like full gilt in the Oval Office. I mean, bits of cherubs painted in gold and all that. It looks appalling, really tacky. Like, what leeway does the Irish president have within the Arras, or like to kind of say, well, paint that wall blue or put up pink wallpaper there? Or is it just in the private areas that they can do that? Do they have a budget?
Usually it's been practice and custom over the years that the president will consult with the OPW and they will provide their expertise and advice, including with the art collection as well. So the OPW, I'd imagine, has the largest art collection in Ireland. So they have the full access to select sculpture, paintings, a whole... mixed media for decorating and furnishing the Arras. So there is a lot of contemporary art in the state rooms, even today, and in the entrance hall. But it's quite similar to the White House in a way that it's just been accepted over the years that there is this kind of arrangement between the White House Historical Association and the president, that cordial relations will prevail. And likewise in the Arras, but Trump has demonstrated how that can be upset.
Yeah, too much control is a bad thing. And of course, there have been references drawn between the American White House, which of course was built by Irish architect James Hoban, and the Áras an Uachtaráin. Now, of course, in scale, they're nothing like each other. Is there an inference to be drawn there between the whiteness, for one thing?
True, they're both classical buildings, so they're both out of that same gene pool, at least. The Arras, of course, the core of the Arras predates the White House. But the White House was painted white actually for a very practical reason. It's actually quite a golden sandstone building. And when it was finished in 1798, they gave it a white lime wash coating to protect it. But in the Arras's case, when they were extending it in the early 19th century, the easiest way to marry the new parts and the existing part was to render over, to ice over the whole
thing. So it looks as if it's like one particular building with the sticky out bits always haven't been there, which of course they haven't been.
And built as a single...
like a stucco nearly. Design. Yeah. Okay, well listen, it'll be a home for the president, but also a big change for any of these three candidates really from what they've been used to. Do you think that there is a kind of a difficulty in stepping into the grandeur of somewhere like that? Like, can it kind of take you aback? We've spoken to Lord Mayors, like we had Emma Blane, Lord Mayor of Dublin, on through, and she was like, there is something about kind of creeping around your own home, you know, because it's such an iconic place. How best do you kind of meld that personal and public life, do you think?
That's it. And I think a lot of presidents have managed to skirt that issue by staying in the much more domestic 1911 wing to one side. So it feels a bit more home, a bit
You're
more...
You're going home in the evening. That's right,
it.
Okay.
And you go through the main door, or rather yeah. side door, and you're into the suite of public entertaining rooms.
But there is a lot of staff. I mean, a building
huge,
like
about
that...
32 staff.
Yeah. yeah, so they can't just leave at 5 o'clock, you know, good night, Uachtaráin, I'm off now, and you have the place to yourself. There's always going to be people around.
Very much, very much. And 'twas ever thus. I mean, when you read about the Viceregal Court in Dublin, in the State Apartments in Dublin Castle, yeah. and in the Viceregal Lodge, I mean, they're going out of their mind with the staff everywhere. Everywhere you move, there's staff. Yeah. So there's that public, as you say, that intersection between public and private is a difficult thing to marry. So, but at the same time, I don't exactly... feel for the new president.
No,
that they're
not
have going wonderful
to.
Grand
we won't take out the violins just yet.
That's it. The violins.
All three of them want to live there. One of them definitely will, and they'll have 7 years at least to get used to it.
So
that's it. All right. Well, listen, Graeme Hickey, CEO of Dublin Civic Trust. Let's hope that the OPW get in at some point. I mean, 6-7 weeks transition isn't a long time between
True.
One resident leaving and another coming in, but very, very interesting look there at the history and the interior of Áras an Uachtaráin.
The Home Show
with Colour Trend, infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk. The Home Show
with Colour Trend, infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Now, with all the bad news about the housing crisis continuing as we head towards Budget Day, one man is tackling the problem head on by promising to deliver 2,000 homes over the next 2 years in Limerick. Mayor John Moran, welcome back to the Home Show.
Thanks for mentioning it.
Now,
great to be here.
You campaigned on housing as a key to your mayorship. Is this the kind of thing you meant?
Yeah, look, I we know how bad housing is across the country. Limerick is no different. I mean, rents have gone up by 61% since 2018. So this is just making it unaffordable for people, not just to buy, but also to rent. So the theory I suppose I came into the election with was that we need to start trialing new stuff and doing things differently. And this is exactly that. It's innovative. It's an intervention by the state requesting government to help us out with some funding or borrowing powers to actually intervene in the rental market as opposed to in the purchase market.
Okay, so the plan is, as I understand it, to build up to 2,000 what are called modular homes over the next couple of years. Now, look, I mean, what do they look like? Where will they be? How big are they?
Yeah, so look, the thing about the important thing we've been trying to do here is to show people what this is like. So one of the other innovations we had is rather than trying to explain to people in sort of PowerPoint slides, we just put two units down in Áras an Uachtaráin and asked people, which is the park for everyone not from Limerick, that's the park right in the city mm-hmm. centre. And we said, basically, come look at these, see, would you or would you think your kids or would you think your friend would be actually, you know, happy to live here? And importantly, it's not live in them forever. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we've all done. Any of us that have lived abroad in other cities, you go to a city, you go for 2 years, 3 years, you're not sure if you're staying, you need to have a home, and you're not working out where you're going to live for the rest of your life. And that's a huge cohort of the people in Limerick that currently can't afford housing. And if we can manage to find a solution that works for them, they will actually leave the other homes that they're using that are suitable for family. So it's a knock-on way through. But for us, the important thing was to ask people, come look at these units, see if you think you'd like them. If there's not enough storage, if the bathroom's too big or whatever, let us know that, because we'll be designing then a unit that we can, in effect, mass produce, which makes it quicker to deliver, not necessarily that much cheaper, but quicker to deliver. And we can put them in lots of different places across the city. And if we want those places back in 15 or 20 years' time, they're designed so we can literally lift them up and move them to another site if we still need housing of this type.
Okay. And now you say you can put them in lots of different sites around Limerick. But like, what power do you have to do that? Because you, like you, are doing lots of innovative things down in Limerick, but you don't control the planning, John. And this is something that, can you circumvent those planning rules, or does each one have to just get holed up for years in planning issues? Because, I mean, that is what's happening around the country.
Yeah, no, so the important thing about how we're approaching this is, and we've done a number of workshops already with the councillors for this, is that we've kind of set out criteria for the places we wanted to do the 2000. In fact, that's why we have 2000, because we might need four, we might need more than that. But initially, we know and have identified a number of plots of ground around Limerick, in the city centre, out in Mungard, places like that, near jobs. And they have to satisfy the criteria that they have to be owned by the state, they have to already be zoned residential, and they already have to have availability of services like, you know, water, etc. And the planning decisions that relate to those sites, because they're owned by the state, actually are made by the councillors. So it's a part-aid process, most likely. So we've been taking the councillors through, explaining what this would look like. And typically, you find that because councillors are very sensitive to local issues and help us to work through those, that you don't get into the same kind of planning issues that you might have if you're a private developer, you know, coming in to do stuff. And also, as I said earlier, these in some places will only be there for 15 or 20 years because there may be a use for that land that's happening afterwards.
And yeah. So I think now, of course, there have been some detractors. I noticed Emma Gleese, the architect, on Twitter saying, look, would this money not be better spent employing architects to design proper towns? We're told we need like more towns, more town centres, not kind of temporary arrangements on brownfield sites. Would you not agree with that, John?
Absolutely. But the point is, we're not just doing this. You know, I think people may have heard in the grapevine, you know, listening what's going on here in Limerick, is that last week and the week before, we were engaged in a conversation about land that we bought, 70 acres, right at the edge of one of the closest villages to the city centre, where we will be getting exactly those architects, we'll be getting in all of the urban planners to design out that whole new neighbourhood for that town so that we kind of do it with proper planning. But that takes time. And the point about this is there isn't a capacity using these modern methods of construction to really accelerate the delivery of some types of housing. And again, I suppose the important thing I've been trying to say is it's not social housing. Our social housing team are still at that. They're moving as fast as they can on that. It's not going to be the private housing that people are so typically used to, you know, where we get the first-time buyers and we get others that are trading there. That's all happening anyway.
So these are more like the, you know, the garden pods we've been told to expect, the kind of 23 square meters, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's our basic unit is 32 square meters, which interestingly, we spent a number of months explaining to the department why we thought people in Limerick would be happy with that. And by the time we had kind of gotten everybody convinced, the great thing is that they made it the new size.
Oh, right. Oh, you inspired them.
So whether we inspired them or they came up with the idea themselves, we don't know, but the outcome is the same.
Okay.
Our basic unit now satisfies that thing. What we've asked people in Limerick that might be looking for a place for a year or for 2 years or 3 years is, would you prefer to save a bit more money because you're saving up to buy a house or you're going to education is costing money and live in a smaller unit, the kind of more like a studio that would know where the bed folds up and it becomes a sofa as opposed to a separate bedroom. Mm. And that's the market research where we're so looking forward to seeing what happens. Because if a lot of people say, I'd prefer to save some more money, it's rent, I don't want to be spending that much money on rent, I'd prefer to spend it on other things, we're basically trying to say, let's provide a cheaper option for people because it's smaller. And it you know, it's a bit like going on a Ryanair flight. I mean, you know, do you want the priority boarding? Do you want all the rest? Or are you actually just trying to get from A to B? And, you know, it's really for us to find out now what people are saying. And I'm hearing some of the reports back. It's really interesting. I think when people are able to step into the spaces and imagine themselves able to live there rather than on a bunk bed, or, you know, sharing a house with one bathroom, you know, with three people who may not know each other, they're all finding this a very attractive option.
Where are you getting the money from?
Well, that's our biggest challenge next. So the first thing we have to do is convince the public of Limerick that this works and make sure that we can do it. Then essentially we're in conversations with the department at the moment about them providing the funding for the first project that we would do. So call that our first leader pilot. But we're going to be trying, as soon as we go into planning for these and design, we're going to be basically looking for the cost of all of the units we need is about 600-700 million in that region. So what we have started to make the case to government about is, look, we need to be able to borrow money, invest in the purchase and the construction of all of those units. The rent that will be paid over the next 25, 30, 40 years will essentially pay back all of the cost of those. And in fact, some mayor sitting in this office in the future will have the borrowing paid off and will have rent coming in still. Right. They can use for other things.
So
but I still need government, and we've had lots of conversations with Pascal and Jack Chambers and others.
You certainly do for half a billion quid. So do you see this, John, a bit like a PPP, you know, the way the toll bridges are built? In other words, you put up the funding now, European Investment Bank, or it's hard to see the Irish government punting it out just for one county. But could you see, is that the kind of the model you want to follow? It's paid back over 20 or 25 years then?
That's a perfect way of thinking. And the way I've seen this in Limerick context, and I do think that the government could do it differently in Limerick. I mean, that's the reason why we have this directly elected mayor role, that it allows us to have separate controls through the various committees that I work on now that don't exist for the county. So I think there is an argument that if the government is up for some innovation, that Limerick is the place to do it. Mm. But it is very much in about 10 or 12 years ago, you'll remember this, others may not. Limerick had a serious problem in terms of jobs crisis after Dell. And we had a problem because we just didn't have enough office space in Limerick because people weren't investing in office space to get people to actually work here. And we set up a company called Limerick 2030, which essentially borrowed money from the EIB and others to build offices, Gardens International, the stuff that's happening in Opera. And they now have helped to mean that our crisis is not creating jobs. We're creating jobs hand over foot, but our problem now is residential accommodation. So I would like Limerick 2030 to essentially be able to do the same kinds of intervention into this housing market until such time as the private sector are actually
catch up,
working at full speed.
All right. Okay, well, listen, it's an interesting proposal. I mean, 2,000 is a big ask. Half a billion is a huge ask. So if anybody can do it, I suppose you'll give it a go,
give
John.
It a good rattle. Yeah, I mean, because it's really important that we do this. I mean, the stories are horrendous about some of the accommodation, you know, including a recent one where we had 18 people living in a single house. I mean, we cannot continue with that. So that's why we really need some brave government decisions now and just to try something different.
All right. Okay, well, very best of luck with that. Lord Mayor of Limerick, John Moran, thanks for joining us on The Home Show.
The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk. The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.
Yes, it is impossible to avoid, so we might as well embrace it. It'll be Halloween in just a few weeks' time and on The Home Show. Now, we don't want you spending a fortune on decor or treats, but you'll definitely want to keep up with the neighbours. So here to give us some spooktacular tips is our favourite little pumpkin, Jennifer Sheehan. Jenny, you're welcome back to The Home Show. Now, listen to me. You love this whole, all this stuff, don't you? You
love it. I love it.
Everything, everything, right. So we're getting two for the price of one now, because I also know that you are a fantastic cook and baker.
Yeah.
So we'll be getting some food tips later on. But let's start with where we can get a great result from a small outlay in terms of the decor, because everybody around the place now will be putting up their orange and black, whatever.
And I'm so here for it. Anything to ward off the inevitable. You know, at the end of the year, like, let's give Halloween its time. I love it. But it's short, you know, it's short, it's sharp, it's high impact. So we don't need to go all out. We don't need to go to huge expense. And especially we
and
don't
it's supposed
need to
be a bit tacky. So nobody's expecting, you know, high end, gorgeous stuff here. But we can have fun.
And what I love about Halloween as well is you can really go for consumables, because we're into autumn, you know, foliage is dying. There's twigs, there's dried leaves, there's all that kind of thing. And we can do a lot with, you know, things that will eventually go into the compost bin because they're great decor. So I do love that. Anyway, so where I love to start is focus on the windows and doors. You're just looking, you know, you don't need to decorate the whole house unless you're having a Halloween party, in which case go nuts. But Windows and doors. When I first moved into my home, I was like, I'm just going to do, you know, for year one, I sat down, I wanted to do something because I love the little trick-or-treaters coming around. And I cut out cardboard silhouettes, painted them black and stuck them on my windows. And I thought, this will get me through year one. And 5 years later, I put them up every year because they're really impactful.
Just so like just witches out, and ghouls and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I cut out bats, I cut out little ghouls, and I cut out a suite, which is so spooky, of tools. You know, so I have a hammer, I have an axe.
Okay.
I have a saw, and it's just, they're kind of hanging in the window and they look really creepy.
And do you backlight them from the window then?
Yeah, so I put candles in the window. That's another great one for Halloween, is pumpkin candles, or ghost candles or ghoul candles or whatever you can find. Skull candles are great. I always find tiger, flying tiger, have a great range of Halloween stuff that's typically quite consumable. Or TK Maxx is your place to go. They have brilliant stuff for Halloween. And maybe little candle holders, you know, or something like that if you just want to put tea lights in them. So that
fabulous.
Looks great and it's really easy. And another thing that's super easy on Windows is chalk pens. You know, the dry erase chalk markers that you can buy. You'll see restaurants, you know, might put their menus on a mirror or something like that. Brilliant for Windows. You can let the kids go insane and, you know, they can't do any damage. They wipe away clean no matter what. So they can draw whatever they want.
That's a great idea. Where do you get those now? In like craft
stores? Go into an arts and craft store. So Art and Hobby or Art Minds if you're in Dublin, or any of those craft stores will have them. And you're looking for dry erase or wet erase. It doesn't matter. Just the chalk, you know, markers, and they're only brilliant.
Brilliant. Okay. That's fine. Now, you were talking there about having nature around us. So foliage is a fantastic, you know, resource. It's free. It's, you know, season appropriate.
Yeah.
What can we do with it?
And it's supposed to look crap, right? So, you know, you've got your dry twigs, like off you go. Just find some branches, find some dried leaves. You can obviously make a wreath. Like it's super, super easy to make a wreath. Just curve some branches around maybe a piece of twine or a piece of wire or something like that, and off you go. You've got your dead leaves. Maybe get some spider webbing. Again, you can buy this in the art and craft shop and it just drapes over it and it all looks a little bit more spooky. And that looks great as wreath, as a foliage on your front door. It's great as a table centerpiece. You could have it along your windowsill, for example, in place of a window box. And there you go. And it's just super, super easy.
Brilliant. All right. Now, repurposing a few bits that we might have at home.
Yeah.
So, like, there's no reason necessarily to go out and buy a whole ton of new stuff. So what kind of things do we have? I mean, we have jars, we have saucers, we have, you know, all kinds of things.
There's endless things you can do with mason jars, right? All around the year. So if you're having a party or if you're serving something, any empty bottles that you have, any empty jars that you have, printing out or even writing, you know, the labels that you can buy, just stick on those and just do something decorative. Write poison on them, write don't drink on them, write, you know, vampire's blood on them, whatever you want. And that's especially fun for kids. They can go a little bit nuts with that. You can buy glass pens, but you don't need to. Like, labels are perfect.
Yeah.
For that.
And even getting loads of jars, because nothing has to match on Halloween, you know, it doesn't have to be like perfect. And putting in, I don't know, going out and get the 50 tea lights.
Yeah.
And I like to put a little kind of line of jars up to my, I have a very short little driveway, but just up so that the kind of the kids can come up through it.
Yeah.
Like little lanterns and that kind of thing is very cheap.
And you can buy, you know, if you want to put candles all over your house, we don't want any fire hazards, especially if you're going with the dried foliage, but you can buy those little rechargeable tea lights, you know, the ones you plug them in,
they're
they go
great.
On, they flicker away and they last forever.
And actually really some of them have the little flickering silk flame, if you like, at the top, which is very effective.
They're really inexpensive. So if you look in Range or if you look in Home Store and More, they typically have loads of those and they're really good value.
Fantastic. All right. And I know that you you like your creepy doll, your creepy toys. What do we
this
do with
that? Such a great one, right? Because like any old Barbies that you have lying around the house or any old dolls or any old teddies or something like that, if it's missing an arm and an eye, even better. So you can get a bit weird with it. You can do, you know, crazy Barbie. You can cut the hair. You can go a bit mad. You can maybe dye the clothes black. You could put some weird lipstick on or whatever you want. But that's a great way to get very, very creepy. I mean, there's nothing weirder than a collection of dolls that are just looking a bit crazy and strange. And that's a great one to troll the charity shops for as well.
You could find something. You'll find a lot of toys in there and, you know, relieve them of them and give some money to charity and then and reuse them in that way. It's fantastic.
Exactly.
All right. You have these cutouts that you keep, but do you tend to have then like, here's my box of Halloween decorations or?
Yeah, I have what I typically have in there. So I have all my cutouts that I keep. I have some candle holders in there that are handy. So pumpkin holders that I can just put the tea lights into and things like that. Yeah. I have a little Halloween costume for my dog, which has been donated.
Harry
this year.
Gets to dress up as.
If Percy Moore is out there, she's listening, she'll be dressing up her little dog Minnie in his old witch's costume this year. Right. Harry needs a new costume, but it's so, like, the kids love it when he comes trick or treating, so that's really handy. But then everything else I tend to get new. So typically it's going to be pumpkins. We did pumpkin carving last year, which is really fun.
Great fun.
Again,
yeah.
Throw them in the compost afterwards and then you're done. And that's so, so, so easy. Gourds, like empty old gourds, you can buy like anything that you have that's lying around. You can carve that out and you can fill it up.
Okay, well, while we're on the subject of food then, I do happen to know that you are a very, very good and accomplished baker.
Yes.
So you have fun with, I mean, the toppings, the decoration, the design.
Yeah.
Tell us what's good.
So these are great. We're back to pumpkin, right? So pumpkin is an easy one. Pumpkin soup, it's amazing. But I'm much better baker than I am a cook, right? So you give me undue credit there at the outset. So all about baking. So first of all, candy apples. Candy apples are easy. They're so great.
Dentists love them. Loads of business
dentists
after Halloween.
Love
with
them.
Those.
And I will say the one thing that's really difficult about them is it can be very easy to dip them in and then get the sugar can be rock hard and you can be licking away at this thing for a day and it can be gone. So just make sure that your whatever recipe you're using, that it stays a little bit soft. You can put a little bit of butter in there, for example.
Okay. And do you
harden.
Stick like then a lollipop stick into the apple? So it's as simple as any kids can do. Yeah. Okay. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. And then you can decorate that if you want. So once that's set, you can get some melted chocolate, white, or you can dye it black if you want to. And you could put some, you could decorate it like a pumpkin carving. You could put some spider webs all over it. You could draw a spider onto it, whatever you like.
Oh, that's good fun, actually, isn't
it? Yeah, that is fun. And they can
and you could have
out.
A
that's
load of them
yeah.
on a tray. So exactly. as the kids call, you can kind of say, pick a candy apple. And they won't be getting that from other houses,
exactly.
you know. So it's a bit
different.
Of fun. They'll remember you. All right. Anything else?
The next thing I do is brownies. So very, very simple batch of brownies. Anyone can whip up brownies. It's very, very hard to go wrong with them. And then what I do is I draw lines of white chocolate all down them and then drag a toothpick down them and then you have spider webs
and you have
all
your webs.
Over your brownies.
Fabulous.
Really
okay.
easy. And the last thing that I have done, and I love this and I always give these away, is make Rice Krispie squares, make a couple of batches of different dyed coloured chocolate, dip the top of the Rice Krispie squares in that, so just the top half, and have it dripping down, have it uneven, doesn't have to look pretty, and then stick a pair of googly eyes on that and you have a whole tray of little Rice Krispie square monsters and they're so easy and kids absolutely love them.
Oh, isn't that a brilliant idea? So you could use white chocolate there.
Yeah,
and
so just melt
yeah,
white
make
chocolate.
Like little ghosts.
Exactly, yeah. You could just use white chocolate and then you can colour it different colours if you want to just have a range of monsters and...
That's such a cool idea. And actually, if you made a tray baker, those, that would do instead of giving out your...
Exactly.
You know, your... like this kind of candy that comes prepackaged in plastic, it's icky. You wouldn't buy it for your own kids.
No.
And shoveling it out to neighbourhood kids isn't really on.
And these are so easy to buy. They're so cheap. You know, a big box of Rice Krispies and some marshmallows and some melted
and great fun.
Yeah.
Brilliant. All right. Well, listen, loads and loads to go on there. You clearly enjoy the season.
I just love them.
Yeah.
And I just think, don't overthink it. Like sometimes Christmas, we like, and it's fine if you do, if you like to get perfect with your Christmas decorations or your Easter decorations. But Halloween is decrepit. It's things rotting. It's broken things. It's rundown houses. It's haunted. And there's a lot you can do as well, you know, that visually, but there's a lot you can do with smells, with sounds. You get a speaker buried in your garden somewhere. You know, it's all atmosphere. So you can really just have fun with it and try it.
Oh, that's fantastic. For a number of years, I had this kind of 5 foot high witch that went, whoa, every time it was sensor motioned.
Oh, God.
But the amount of times, you know, I'd say to the kids, go turn that thing off overnight before you go to bed. And suddenly a fox would run past it and, whoa. It was a little bit too realistic. All right. Well, listen, Jenny, enjoy that. We will have you on again before Halloween, but great stuff there. I know you're getting into it right now and you're doing all that kind of stuff. So super tips and hints there as ever from Jenny Sheehan, former Home of the Year winner. And you can find Jenny on Instagram at Workers Cottage. And that's all we have time for on this week's episode of the Home Show podcast. Hope you've enjoyed our mix of guests and topics. But if you'd like to suggest one or get in touch with us at all, well, then email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com or you can find me on Instagram and on X. Thanks to producer Aoife Breen. Stephen McLoone was on sound. And we will do it all again next week. And we look forward to your company.
The Home Show.
With Colour Trend. Infinite colour from Ireland.
This is News Talk.